When Ajahn Suwad was a young monk, he spent some time with Ajahn Mun shortly before Ajahn Mun passed away. And he said that during that time, there were two Dharma themes that Ajahn Mun liked to stress more than anything else. One was practicing the Dharma in accordance with the Dharma. Does it sound that loud enough? Can you hear me? Turn up the volume. How about this? Oh yeah, okay. There are two Dharma themes that Ajahn would like to teach more than anything else. One was practicing the Dharma in accordance with the Dharma. And then there was the customs of the noble ones. We tend to think of the forest tradition as being very Thai, very Lao. But Ajahn Mun was accused of not following Thai customs, not following Laotian customs. Because most monks back in those days were pretty domesticated. And Ajahn Mun was still a wild monk, you might say. Living in the forest, eating only one meal a day, wandering around, and being very strict about the Vinaya. Some people would accuse him of not following Thai or Laotian customs. He would tell them he aspired to be a noble one, and if you want to be a noble one, you have to follow their customs. As for the customs of Thai and Laotian people, like the customs of societies everywhere, they were the customs of people with defilements. They wanted to find some way to get out of those customs. So think about that as you're practicing here. We keep running into things that are not quite the American way of doing things or the Western way of doing things. But don't think you're being forced to simply follow Thai customs. We're trying to follow the customs of the noble ones. There's a sutta where the Buddha lays them out. There are four. The first three have to do with the first three of the requisites. You're content with any old cloth at all for your robes. You're content with any old food. You're content with any old shelter. In other words, as long as it's good enough to practice, it's good enough. You don't have to aspire to anything more than that. And right there, you're bucking a lot of the customs of the world. Because so much of society, and particularly the economy, is based on people wanting more than they really need. There was that incident back in the 50s when the Americans were afraid that Thailand would fall to the communists. So they wanted to study Thai culture, Thai traditions, to see what there was in the Thai tradition that might make them susceptible to become communist and how that might be changed. And one thing they found was, of course, the teaching on contentment. And so they consulted the leaders of the country and they said, you should teach people not to be content. After all, they wanted Thailand to be a good capitalist country. It was going to require people to want more than they really needed, to get more into debt than they had to. And so word went out from the government for monks to stop teaching contentment. Well, everybody laughed. At least back in the 50s, they had the good sense to laugh. Now, however, you see that the attitude of contentment has pretty much disappeared from Thailand. And it weakens the country. And you look at that on a large scale, then you look at yourself on the small scale. Because when you're not content, when society can try to sell you on wanting more than you really need in terms of food, clothing, and shelter, you have to play along with their values. If they want you to be fearful, they can threaten you that these things are going to suffer from hardships, they're going to suffer from lack, they're going to become more expensive. So one way of getting out of the control of customs based on defilement, is learning how to be content with just enough to practice. It's your expression of freedom. Think of it that way. There are times in Thailand when the people in the neighborhood were trying to exert pressure on a John Fuang, and so they would withhold alms. But because he was used to living very simply, it had no effect on him. And so one by one by one, the different people who had agreed to withhold alms ended up realizing, okay, they were missing an opportunity to make merit. And so in contentment is strength. And freedom. Now, however, there can be the problem of pride. So the Buddha says, as part of the customs of the noble ones, you try to make sure that you don't have pride over your contentment. In other words, you don't look down on people who are not content. And you don't exalt yourself for getting along with just a little. You think of that Onion article about the monk raising his arms in victory. He'd just been declared the most serene in the Dharma Olympics. We're not doing this to compete with anyone else. We're doing this because we see we have a disease within our minds, the disease of greed. And we need to develop contentment as a way of counteracting that disease. So just as you don't compare yourself with other people who are sick, seeing who's better at taking medicine, who's better at getting cured, you focus on your cure. And you focus on why you're doing this. And you encourage others. That they will do well to be content as well. Now, given that the first three of the customs have to do with the requisites, you would think that the fourth would also have to do with the fourth requisite, in other words, medicine. But it doesn't. At least not in the Theravada tradition. The Buddha sets that out as finding delight in developing, finding delight in abandoning. To delight in developing skillful qualities, to delight in abandoning unskillful qualities. This is where you're not content. You don't simply tell yourself, oh, here comes an instance of suffering, I'll just watch it come and go and not be worked up about it. Here comes some craving, I'll just watch it come and go and not get worked up about it. Because if you just take that attitude as a passive observer, these things are going to keep coming back. And no matter how fancy you make your explanation as to how you're like an awakened person by being very equanimous about these things, you have to remember we're following a path. And the path is not going to be the same thing as the fruit of the path. Think of the road to the Grand Canyon. The road to the Grand Canyon is not a canyon. It's a road. And it goes to some very flat land. It doesn't look like a canyon at all, at least the road coming from the south. And of course, the road doesn't make the Grand Canyon exist, but if you follow it, it takes you there. So we follow the road. And this is the road. Developing skillful qualities, abandoning unskillful qualities, and learning how to delight in it. Because all too often, as a John Suwat would say, we take craving as our friend and we see suffering as our enemy. But you have to learn how to see that getting rid of that friendship is something you really want to do. And part of that is learning how to spend some time with suffering, get to know it well. You become friends to the extent that you're willing to be intimate with so you can really understand it. So ultimately you can get past it. But as for your friendship with craving, you've really got to put that under the microscope. See where it is that you're craving, why you're craving. Because craving can be devious. You think you're craving one thing, and actually it's something else. And so you can tell yourself all about the drawbacks of that first thing, and it doesn't really affect the craving at all, because the craving is focused someplace else. As the Buddha said, you can be focused on sights, sounds, smells, tastes, tactile sensations. You can be focused on your sense of sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch. Be focused on feelings around these things, perceptions around these things, thoughts, acts of evaluation, even craving for these things. You can crave the craving. So when you think you crave one thing, ask yourself, is it really that thing? Is that where your craving is located? Maybe it's in a perception you have about this thing, an association you have with it. And this is how advertising works. And this is another reason why it's good to practice contentment, because when you're exposed to advertisements and they're trying to get you to associate the item they're selling with an attitude or a perception of yourself, the fact that you're trying to be content with little makes it easier to see through these things and gives you some education in your other desires about where they're focused, how they can deceive you. But then take this as a challenge and be up for the challenge. It's a puzzle you're trying to take apart. So it's the practice of contentment pushes you up against some desires. Don't get frustrated by it. Don't get frustrated by the training. Get frustrated by the fact that you don't understand things, but don't let that frustration stop you. Try to understand it. Think of this as a puzzle you're trying to take apart, and you're fascinated by the puzzle. Because what could be more fascinating than the way the mind lies to itself, and then searching it out and uncovering the lies? This is your own mind, and it's been deceiving you. And so you want to be able to look through the deceits, trace them down, and take some joy in this. There is joy in effort with that sense of accomplishment, a sense of understanding things that were unclear before. So when you take joy in trying to develop skillful qualities and abandon unskillful ones, not regarded as something that frustrates you or something that blocks what you really want to do, but you turn around and look, okay, why is it I'm feeling hemmed in by this situation? Because it's actually your craving that's hemming you in. You get rid of the craving, then you're free. We're working on freedom here. Contentment with material things is aimed at freedom. Delighting in developing skillful qualities and abandoning unskillful ones, that's aimed at freedom as well. Not the freedom of just doing what you want, but the freedom of coming out from under the power of these things. So on the one hand, society outside can't push you around because you don't fall for the baits. And so your greed, aversion, and delusion don't push you around, because again, you don't fall for their baits either. Just when you follow these four customs, they are customs for the sake of freedom. That's what the noble ones are here for. That's why they left their teachings behind. They found freedom this way, and they said this is how you can find freedom too. Think of a John Munn and all that he had to learn. He was one of these people who, in the course of Buddhist history, you find them every now and then. Where their tradition gets moribund, and they have to bring it back to life. And it wasn't easy. But again, he found delight in doing that, even though it was hard. Now we've got the teachings available. The situation around us, is, for the time being at least, is more comfortable. It may not last that way for long. So look to these traditions, look to these customs, can see them as customs that liberate you from whatever customs you've been following before. They're not an imposition. They're opportunities. And when you see them in that way, the requirements of the training become very light. Because you see they're basically on your side. As long as you want true freedom, as long as you want true happiness, they're showing you the way.